This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents New Power. How power works in our hyper-connected world and how to make it work for you. By Jeremy Hymans and Henry Timms. Read for you by Andrew Falaise. Chapter 1. Welcome to the New Power World. Power, as philosopher Bertrand Russell puts it, is the ability to produce intended effects. That ability is now in all our hands. Today, we have the capacity to make films, friends, or money, to spread hope or spread our ideas, to build community or build up movements, to spread misinformation or propagate violence, all on a vastly greater scale and with greater potential impact than we did even a few years ago. Yes, this is because technology has changed. But the deeper truth is that we are changing. Our behaviors and expectations are changing. And those who have figured out how to channel all this energy and appetite are producing Russell's intended effects in new and extraordinarily impactful ways. Think of the hoodie-clad barons who sit atop online platforms, a billion users strong, tweaking our daily habits, emotions, and opinions. The political neophytes who have raised passionate crowds and won stunning victories. The everyday people and organizations who are leaping ahead in this chaotic, hyper-connected world, while others fall back. This book is about how to navigate and thrive in a world defined by the battle and balancing of two big forces. We call them old power and new power. Old power works like a currency. It is held by a few. Once gained, it is jealously guarded, and the powerful have a substantial store of it to spend. It is closed, inaccessible, and leader-driven. It downloads and it captures. New power operates differently, like a current. It is made by many. It is open, participatory, and peer-driven. It uploads and it distributes, like water or electricity. It's most forceful when it surges. The goal with new power is not to hoard it, but to channel it. To start to see how old and new power work, here are three very different stories. Hashtag Me Too versus Harvey Weinstein. Awards season after awards season, movie producer Harvey Weinstein ruled over Hollywood like a god. In fact, between 1966 and 2016, he actually tied with God for the total number of times each was thanked in acceptance speeches on Oscar night, 34. His films garnered over 300 Oscar nominations. The Queen made him an honorary commander of the British Empire. Weinstein hoarded his power and spent it like currency to maintain his vaunted position. He could make or break a star. He had huge personal capacity to greenlight a project or sink it. He shaped the fortunes of an entire industry, and in turn, that industry protected him, even as he carried out a decades-long spree of alleged sexual harassment and assault. He controlled the media through developing a cozy, mutually beneficial relationship based on the favors and access he could grant. He even won the 2017 Los Angeles Press Club Truth Teller Award. He buffeted himself with an army of lawyers, relying on punishing non-disclosure agreements for those who worked with him and, when necessary, paying off accusers. He hired private security firms staffed with former spies to dig for information on women and journalists with allegations against him. The women he preyed upon mostly kept quiet anyway, out of the very real fear of career consequences, while the men who might have stepped up stood by and did nothing, unwilling to spend their own power on a fight. If Harvey Weinstein and the closed and hierarchical system that held him up tell a familiar story about old power, then Weinstein's fall, and especially what happened next, tells us a lot about how new power works and why it matters. In the days after news stories broke about Weinstein and his accusers, the actress Alyssa Milano shared the hashtag, #MeToo, to encourage women to tell their stories of sexual harassment and assault on Twitter. Terry Conn paid attention. In her 20s, as an emerging actress with a role on a soap opera, Conn had been approached by director James Toback to meet in Central Park to talk about a part. Once there, as she reported to CNN, he assaulted her. She buried the memory for years, but with the attention on Harvey Weinstein and the rise of the hashtag MeToo movement, it resurfaced. She finally told her husband, and she started to act. She began by searching Twitter for women who had used both the hashtag MeToo hashtag and hashtag James Toback. She found others whose stories were frighteningly close to hers. Together, they formed a private Twitter group to support one another and find other survivors. Members of this group then took their stories to a journalist at the Los Angeles Times. Within days of an article being published, more than 300 women came forward with stories of their own about Toback. Conn's campaign was one of many. Almost 1 million tweets used the hashtag, #MeToo, in 48 hours. In just one day, 12 million Facebook comments, posts and reactions were logged. The hashtag MeToo movement surged across the world like a current, with different communities adapting it to take on their own targets. In France, it became hashtag balance ton porc, denounce your pig, a campaign to name and shame harassers. In Italy, women recounted their stories under the banner hashtag quella volta che, the time that. And it moved from industry to industry. Members of Congress revealed that they, too, had been harassed by their male peers. The UK Defence Minister was forced to resign. The European Parliament had its hashtag MeToo moment. Business leaders were exposed and toppled. Rallies spilled out onto the streets in cities across the world, from Paris to Vancouver. India debated an effort to expose the predatory behaviour of well-known professors. An article in China Daily that seemed to suggest workplace harassment and assault were only Western problems was pulled after a wave of online criticism. No one was the boss of this movement, and no one quite knew where it would go next. Hashtag MeToo had been born a decade earlier as the work of grassroots activist Tarana Burke, who encouraged women of color who had been sexually assaulted to share their experiences peer-to-peer with other survivors. But now the movement felt ownerless, and this was the source of its strength. Everyone from enterprising designers who created MeToo jewelry to aspiring politicians who aligned with hashtag MeToo to seek to channel its energy. The most striking thing about hashtag MeToo was the sense of power it gave to its participants. Many who had felt for years that they were helpless to stop long-time abusers or had been afraid of retribution suddenly found the courage to stand up to them. Every individual story was strengthened by the surge of the much larger current. Each individual act of bravery was, in fact, made by many. The patient, or the patients, versus the doctor. The doctor looked up from his computer, stunned. Where did you learn that word? That's my terminology. When did you go to medical school? I can't see you as a patient anymore if you're going to go on the internet and just learn stuff that you shouldn't be learning. Then the doctor fired his patient. The offensive word was tonic-clonic. His patient had let him know that she thought she had experienced a secondarily generalized tonic-clonic seizure. In the past, she and her doctor had referred to these moments as space-outs, regular seizures that had been causing her serious concern. This patient had learned about her condition through Patients Like Me, an online community of over 500,000 people living with more than 2,700 diseases, each of whom shares their personal medical data and experiences with others on the platform, creating tens of millions of data points. Think of it as a massive support group, learning community, and data set all rolled into one. Patients on the platform have even worked together to crowdsource their own drug trials, such as when a group of ALS patients conducted a test of lithium as a treatment in a fraction of the time it would have taken the health authorities. Letitia Brown-James, another member of the community, stumbled upon patients like me out of desperation. She had suffered from epilepsy her whole life, enduring frequent and debilitating seizures that were just getting worse. She feared having a seizure in school or in church, while she was acting or dancing, or, as she got older, on a date. After she met her future husband, Jonah James Jr., she worried about her wedding day. I prayed really hard, just asking God to allow me to let me make it through that day without having a seizure, she said. While her neurologist kept on prescribing the same old medications, she began to confer with community members on the platform, learning for herself about why certain drugs weren't working and trying to figure out what other options might be possible. Chasing any kind of hope, she was told of the promise of brain surgery as a treatment for people with epilepsy. She discovered that 83% of her fellow patients on the platform had reported positive outcomes from this type of treatment, yet it was something she and her doctor had never even discussed. So this patient fired her doctor. As a parting request, she asked for the name of an epileptologist, the type of specialist she had learned about from her patient community. The doctor flipped through the papers on his desk and gave her a name. She was aghast. He had had that information there all the time, she said. Letitia underwent the surgery. She has now had more than 5 years without a single seizure, and she has mentored many others on patients like me, helping them take control of their health. The doctors in these stories live in a world that runs on old power. They have trained rigorously to develop their expertise, and for good reason. They are dealing with matters of life and death. But in doing so, they have become accustomed to being the keepers of medical knowledge, distanced from their patients by a hyphenated lexicon and inscrutable prescriptions. The patients have discovered new power. They act to improve their own conditions, surrounded and rallied by a crowd of like-minded people. They try things out, swap journal articles, and track each other's progress. They share their data, ideas, and compassion. Their worlds have opened up, and no doctor can put that genie back in its bottle. The schoolgirl versus the State Department. Aksa Mahmood grew up part of a moderate Muslim family in Scotland. She attended good private schools and loved Harry Potter. She was described as someone who didn't know which bus to take to find her way to downtown Glasgow. Yet over time, she became a bedroom radical, falling into a dark online ecosystem of persuasive content and seductive recruiters. Then one day in November, when she was just 19 years old, she disappeared. When her parents next heard from her, 4 days later, she was calling them from the Syrian border. But this was not the end of her story. Having been recruited into ISIS, she now turned recruiter, mastering the tools of online engagement and enticing others to follow her example. She built a close-knit, girl-to-girl network, sending encouragement and offering practical advice for wannabe jihadi women who were preparing to make the journey to Syria. If I could advise you to bring one thing, it would be organic coconut oil. Maybe grab an extra jar for me as well, LOL. This is such a helpful product with multi-use. Body moisturizer, hair oil, etc. When three normal and well-liked girls from Bethnal Green, London, plotted their own departure for Syria, it was Aksa Mahmood to whom they reached out on Twitter. While Aksa used intimate peer-to-peer methods to win over recruits, the US government took a very different approach to try to dissuade them. It printed thousands of cartoons of ISIS recruits being fed into a meat grinder and dropped them out of an F-16 fighter jet as it flew over ISIS strongholds in Syria, an approach that had first been widely used 100 years earlier during World War I. It tried a digital approach too, in an attempt to match the Islamic State's online savvy, creating a rather bossy Twitter account, replete with an ominous State Department seal that instructed potential jihadis to think again, turn away. This was perhaps not the most persuasive messenger if you're trying to pull radicalized people back from the brink. Here again we see old power meeting new power. The US government was relying on a trusty old power playbook, using its superior position to literally drop ideas from on high. Even when using social media, its default is not to engage, but to command. AXA is doing something very different. Her makeshift metastasizing network is participatory and peer-driven. It moves not top-down, but sideways, from girl to girl. It is new power at its most effective and most terrifying. The ingredients of new power. What the hashtag MeToo movement, our patients, and a Scottish schoolgirl all have in common is that they figured out how to use today's tools to channel an increasing thirst to participate. People have always wanted to take part in the world. Throughout history, movements have surged, people have organized collectively, communities have built collaborative structures to create culture and conduct commerce. There has always been a dialectic between bottom-up and top-down, between hierarchies and networks. But until recently, our everyday opportunities to participate and agitate were much more constrained. Thanks to today's ubiquitous connectivity, we can come together and organize ourselves in ways that are geographically boundless and highly distributed and with unprecedented velocity and reach. This hyper-connectedness has given birth to new models and mindsets that are shaping our age, as we'll see in the program ahead. That's the new in new power. A popular thread on Reddit, the link-sharing platform, crowdsourced memories of growing up in the 1990s when life felt very different. For those who were there, the posts offered warm nostalgia. For those who weren't born yet, it told stories of an alien world. The anxiety of waiting for your yearbook photo to arrive, which was the only time you saw a picture of you and your friends at school. You only got one shot to get that right, and you never knew how it would turn out. The tension of calling the local radio station requesting your favorite song, and then waiting, fingers poised on the record button of your tape cassette player, to capture it when it came on. The excitement of stopping by the Blockbuster video store to rent a movie on the way home. The frustration of going to the library and finding the one book you need has already been taken out, or should be in the stacks but can't be found. The tedium of doing math without a calculator because they were banned. The sturdy reasoning being, you won't have a calculator in your pocket all the time when you grow up. Of course, we now have much more than a calculator in our pocket. In today's world, we all have our hands, quite literally, on what we can think of as a new means of participation. And this isn't just changing what we can do, but how we expect to engage. These new means of participation and the heightened sense of agency that has come with them are a key ingredient in some of the most impactful models of our time. Big businesses like Airbnb and Uber, China's WeChat or Facebook, protest movements like Black Lives Matter, open software systems like GitHub, and terrorist networks like ISIS. They are all channeling new power. Think of these as new power models. New power models are enabled by the activity of the crowd, without whom these models are just empty vessels. In contrast, old power models are enabled by what people or organizations own, know, or control that nobody else does. Once old power models lose that, they lose their advantage. Old power models ask of us only that we comply, pay your taxes, do your homework, or consume. New power models demand and allow for more. That we share ideas, create new content, as on YouTube, or assets, as on Etsy, even shape a community. Think of the sprawling digital movements resisting the Trump presidency. To grasp the essential difference between old and new power models, think of the difference between the two biggest computer games of all time, Tetris and Minecraft. You will likely remember the block-based game Tetris, which exploded with the Game Boy craze of the 1990s. The way it worked was simple. Blocks fell down from the top of the screen, and the player's job was to make them fit into neat, regular lines. They came down faster and faster, until the player was eventually overwhelmed. In old power fashion, the player had a limited role, and you could never beat the system. New power models work more like Minecraft, now the second biggest game of all time. Like Tetris, it is a clunky block-based game, but it operates very differently. Instead of a model built on top-down compliance, it is a game built from the bottom up, with players around the world co-creating worlds together, block by block. It relies entirely on participatory energy. In the world of Minecraft, you will find houses, temples and wallmarks, dragons, caves, boats, farms and roller coasters, working computers made by engineers, forest fires, dungeons, cinemas, chickens and stadiums. The players set their rules and create their own tasks. There is no manual. Players learn from the example and often the homemade videos of others. Some players, known as modders, are even trusted with the capacity to alter the game itself. Without the actions of the players, Minecraft is a wasteland. A key dynamic in the world today is the mutual incomprehension between those raised in the Tetris tradition and those with a Minecraft mindset. The mission of this book. The future will be a battle over mobilization. The everyday people, leaders and organizations who flourish will be those best able to channel the participatory energy of those around them for the good, for the bad, and for the trivial. This matters in the daily lives of all of us. Since we first wrote about these ideas in the Harvard Business Review, it has been inspiring to see people in so many different sectors using them to reimagine their worlds, from librarians to diplomats to health workers. In the chapters ahead, we will tell stories of organizations and individuals who understand these new dynamics. We'll unpack how the Lego company saved its brand by turning to the crowd. We'll consider how TED grew from an exclusive conference into one of the biggest ideas communities in the world. We'll look at how Pope Francis is trying to shift the nature of his church by empowering his flock. We'll introduce some lesser-known examples too. Nurses banding together to cut down on bureaucracy and improve patients' lives and their own job satisfaction. A car company that turns to its customers to design its vehicles. A successful media company built, funded, and shaped by its readers. Whether you are a historian yearning to share your knowledge in a post-truth world, a determined parent running for your local school board, or a creator wanting to get a new product off the ground, there are a range of distinctive new capabilities that people and businesses need to discover. The skills in question are often misunderstood as the ability to self-promote on Facebook or as Snapchat for dummies. But new power is about much more than just new tools and technologies. As the State Department showed us in their failed online sparring with the Islamic State, many are still deploying these new means of participation in profoundly old power ways. This book is about a different approach to the exercise of power, and a different mindset which can be deployed even as particular tools and platforms go in and out of fashion. How do you create ideas that the crowd grabs onto, makes stronger, and helps spread? How do you operate effectively within an organization in which your, perhaps younger, peers have internalized new power values like radical transparency or constant feedback? How do you create an institution that inspires an enduring, mass following in an era of much looser, more transitory affiliation? How do you switch between old and new power? When should you blend them together? And when will old power actually produce better outcomes? This book will answer these questions and more, drawing on examples from some of the most inspiring new power success stories and some of the big cautionary tales from around the world. This matters for society at large. New power is here to stay and is, in many sectors, ascendant. In the right hands, it is doing wonders. The crowd-sourced drug trials, the fast-growing movements in the name of love and compassion. Yet in the wrong hands, as we see with ISIS or the growing hordes of white supremacists, these same skills can be enormously destructive. The tools that bring us closer together can also drive us further apart. Those who are building and stewarding vast platforms that run on new power have become our new elites. These leaders often use the language of the crowd, sharing, open, connected. But their actions can tell a different story. Think of Facebook, the new power platform that most of us know best. For all those likes and smiley faces we create using what the company calls our power to share, the 2 billion users of Facebook get no share of the vast economic value created by the platform, nor any say in how it is governed, and not a peek into the algorithm that has been proven to shape our moods, our self-esteem, and even some elections. Far from the organic free-roaming paradise the early internet pioneers imagined, there is a growing sense that we are living in a world of participation farms, where a small number of big platforms have fenced and harvest for their own gain the daily activities of billions. The stakes are high for democracy as well. Many hoped that surges of social media alone would topple dictators. But in fact, a new kind of strongman is on the rise in many parts of the world, supercharged by the very tools some believed could only democratize. Take Donald Trump. Trump became the leader of a vast, decentralized social media army who took cues from him and who in turn fed Trump new narratives and lines of attack. It was a deeply symbiotic relationship. He retweeted his most extreme supporters. He offered to pay the legal fees of supporters who punched protesters at his rallies. He drove the intensity of his crowd not by insisting they read his talking points, but by empowering them to activate around his values. Think of him as a platform strongman, mastering new power techniques to achieve authoritarian ends. In the chapters ahead, we will explain the dynamics that make participation farms and platform strongmen possible. Critically, we'll also showcase stories of their antidotes, those new models that genuinely shift and distribute power to more people, including the least powerful among us. We'll meet pioneers who are imagining ways to reinvent democracy, not undermine it, finding ways to transform citizens from hostile outsiders to co-owners and valuable players in the work of government. We'll also visit traditional institutions in vital parts of society that are taking the tough turn from old to new power. We hope this book equips those fighting for a more open, democratic, and pluralistic world with the tools they need to prevail. This book is grounded in our own experience creating new power models and trying to bring more participation to more people. Henry launched hashtag Giving Tuesday, a philanthropic meme that became a movement, raising hundreds of millions of dollars for charities around the world. Jeremy created a technology-powered political movement in his home country of Australia as a 20-something that became the biggest in the nation, and he has since helped to launch many more movements around the world via his organization Purpose, headquartered in New York. We've seen the potential and pitfalls of new power up close, and now we want to share what we've learned. We've been working together and engaging with businesses and communities to dig deeper into what's changing, why, and what we can all do about it. In the program ahead, we'll share what we've discovered. Chapter 2. Thinking Old Power, Thinking New Power. The Lab is My World versus The world is my lab. NASA's Johnson Space Center is legendary for taking on great challenges. When the Apollo astronauts broadcast, "Houston, we've had a problem," it was the Johnson Space Center they were calling. In 2010, though, NASA faced the danger of having its budget slashed by Congress, its utility implicitly questioned. It was under scrutiny, too, for a lack of imagination. As the head scientist at Johnson told his troops, "HQ are telling us we are not innovative enough. We need to show they're wrong." So they began to experiment with something called open innovation. Open innovation is the concept of enlisting the crowd to help solve your problem. Unlike the old power method, where a small number of experts have exclusive access to tools, data, and machines, the goal of open innovation is to invite everyone to engage. The story of NASA's efforts to open up comes from the research and insights of NYU professor Hila Lifshitz-Asaf. She spent 3 years deep inside the agency, a fly on the wall for a period of dramatic and tense change. The Johnson Space Center's effort was led by its Space Life Sciences Directorate, SLSD, under doctor and flight surgeon Jeffrey Davis. The directorate picked out 14 strategic research and development challenges and laid them out on open innovation platforms for the world to take on. 3,000 people in 80 countries responded, ranging from recognized experts to unrecognized weekend enthusiasts. The initial results were impressive. The typical traditional R&D, research and development, cycle was 3 to 5 years, yet the crowd was turning problems around in 3 to 6 months. And not only did the crowd produce quicker solutions at much lower cost, the quality of its work was significantly higher than expected. One solution stood out above the others and became a symbol of the promise of the approach. It addressed a serious problem in heliophysics: how hard it was to forecast solar storms effectively. Solar storms are huge bursts of energy from the sun that travel toward the Earth at 3 million miles per hour. Obviously, the ability to avoid them is a high priority for those traveling the solar system. Yet for all of the work done by experts around the world, at NASA and elsewhere, the best models allowed for forecasts at 1 to 2 hours' notice and with a 50% level of accuracy. And now, Bruce Cragen, a semi-retired telecommunications engineer from New Hampshire, who wasn't even a heliophysicist and didn't have access to anything like the tools at NASA, had submitted an algorithm that allowed for prediction 8 hours in advance with a 75% level of accuracy. This breakthrough kicked off a huge wave of enthusiasm among NASA's senior leadership, grabbing the attention of the national media and even piquing the interest of the White House. So NASA doubled down. Jeffrey Davis pulled together a much larger group and rolled out a special workshop to unite the team around the promise of this new approach. The day kicked off with a lot of excitement and a bold claim from one of the workshop leaders: "This puts you on the edge of many organizations, in many ways of all organizations in the world, trying to figure out this open innovation perspective." Yet rather than cueing a wave of enthusiasm, the meeting unfolded into mayhem. Lifshitz-Asaf describes the scene at the workshop. "The tensions, debates, and forces unleashed on that day led to a very different trajectory than that planned. The intensity of fears and resistance expressed in the room throughout the day was out of the ordinary." The rough translation of this academic analysis is, people went nuts. What had happened? Why had a promising opportunity led to such intense feeling and division? Over the months ahead, Davis and his team, bruised but determined, pushed on with their open innovation efforts, and they began to see two very different factions form. One camp viewed it all as a waste of time, a nuisance and a threat. They grumbled about the budgetary impact of the new work. They nitpicked technical details. Some refused to discuss problems they were struggling with, fearing it might be transformed into an open innovation challenge. Some turned saboteur, dissuading their colleagues from taking part. Others showed enthusiasm in public, but provided the scantest details for the crowd to engage with, and ignored their ideas when they arrived. One team even went into full denial mode, withholding the fact it was actually participating in open innovation. The other camp saw opportunity. They created new processes and approaches to get the best out of their crowd. They invented tools that opened up their labs for knowledge to flow in and out. Some left their roles altogether to set up Open NASA, a new unit dedicated to fostering the work. One team founded the now annual Space Apps Hackathon, perhaps the most global of all such efforts, which in 2017 brought together 25,000 people in 187 locations in 69 countries over 3 days to engage with some of space's trickiest challenges. Another built an open platform to engage with a community of space experts and citizen scientists worldwide. Today, this appetite for open innovation at NASA has grown so much that there is now a senior policy advisor in the office of the chief scientist with responsibility for engaging citizens to add value across the whole agency. Were this any normal legacy institution, you might assume that this divide had something to do with people fearing new technology. But this was clearly not the case. After all, these were literally rocket scientists. Nor was the division about age or experience or reputation. The populations of the two camps looked pretty similar. What was behind this big divide were two very different ways of thinking. The first group had what we call old power values. They came from a world with clear boundaries between us and them, where only the lab-coated and credentialed were equipped to solve the mysteries of the cosmos. As one leading scientist explained, the resistance to open innovation is really intrinsic. The history of the scientific method goes against it. In our training, trying to solve problems in the scientific method was, I take in all this information, I synthesize it, I do analysis, and I come to some conclusion. And so to reach out to other people to solve it, it's like cheating. This group believed deeply in the value of expertise. Their own identities grew out of a tradition that venerated individual moments of genius. Archimedes leaping from his bath, Newton getting an apple on his noggin. Their instinct was to hoard information about their work, not expose it to the scrutiny of an unqualified crowd who might not play by the established rules of scientific inquiry and debate. They had some reason to be skeptical. Many experiments in open innovation and crowdsourcing end up failing. These were people who had, in many cases, made enduring, decades-long commitments to NASA, and they weren't going to let some dilettante swan in and supplant them. Professional privileges and knowledge were hard-won currency. You are what you have amassed. Tellingly, Liefschitz Asaf notes that when people in this group were asked about open innovation, they would often, without prompting, start talking about why they joined NASA, who they are, and how they were trained. They'd start talking about their PhD mentors, pulling out their research papers and showing her the various professional artifacts from their careers, a demonstration of the sweat and hard work of many years. What she found odd about this, of course, was, I didn't ask them about them, I asked them about open innovation. The looming crowd, she concluded, presented a threat to their core identity. This was a group for whom the answer to, Houston, we've had a problem, could never be, stand by Apollo, we're going to crowdsource that and see if any semi-retired telecommunications engineers in New Hampshire have any insights. The second group had new power values. They were more open to collaboration, believed in the possibility of crowd wisdom, and wanted to open up their world to let others join in. They decided that their teams would be stronger if they could find ways to create discrete assignments that anyone around the world could help out with. For this group, even the water cooler tales they told began to change. One popular story emerged of an engineer who wanted to identify a breakthrough medical device that could be used on the International Space Station and found it by reaching out on YouTube. These scientists stopped thinking, the lab is my world, and started thinking, the world is my lab. A tale of two mindsets. Old power and new power values are not clashing just at NASA. More broadly, two very different mindsets are doing battle in today's world. Old power value, formal representative governance, managerialism, institutionalism. New power value, informal networked governance, opt-in decision-making, self-organization. Old power value, competition, exclusivity, resource consolidation. New power value, collaboration, crowd wisdom, sharing, open sourcing. Old power value, confidentiality, discretion, separation between private and public spheres. New power value, radical transparency. Old power value, expertise, professionalism, specialization. New power value, maker culture, do-it-ourselves ethic. Old power value, long-term affiliation and loyalty, less overall participation. New power value, short-term conditional affiliation, more overall participation. The 20th century was built from the top down. Society was imagined as a great machine, intricately powered by big bureaucracies and great corporations. To keep the machine humming, ordinary people had critical but small and standardized roles to play. Do your drills, say your prayers, learn your multiplication tables, serve your time, sit for your yearbook photo. Many of us were relatively content to play a minor role in a larger process. Yet the rise of new power is shifting people's norms and beliefs about how the world should work and where they should fit in. The more we engage with new power models, the more these norms are shifting. Indeed, what is emerging, most visibly among people under 30, now more than half the world's population, is a new expectation, an inalienable right to participate. The YouTube creator with her own robust set of followers approaches the world expecting to be a creator more than a consumer. A person who stitches together a living as a producer for TaskRabbit, Lyft, or other on-demand services may become less reliant on and more skeptical of traditional economic intermediaries. An employee who gets the thrill of unlimited creativity and immediate validation from her online community can find her mundane daily workplace projects, which her boss rarely comments on, especially unfulfilling. A citizen who becomes deeply involved in a crowd-funded project she has backed in her neighborhood may become disillusioned or disengaged when her interactions with her local government are mainly in the form of summonses and paperwork. Participatory experiences are multiplying across all of our lives and further shaping this new power mindset. It is important not to see all this in normative terms. This is not a case of new power values equals good, old power values equals bad. After all, there are many times we might choose old power values over new. If you're having a root canal done, for example, you'd almost certainly value the expertise of an endodontist with 2 degrees and 15 years experience over a group of collaborative amateurs and wannabe weekend makers who had crowdsourced their drills and picked up the technique from an anonymous post on Reddit. And while these two mindsets often come into conflict, we shouldn't see the values as a binary. It's better to see them as a spectrum, and to consider where your beliefs and those of the organizations you are part of might sit along them. Let's unpack each set of values. Formal versus informal governance. We've heard people say that teachers have no business going rogue and trying to select their own books, technology, and classes, and citizens have no business deciding what is worthy. And yes, we have a position on that and a response to people who raise that question. Screw you. We believe in teachers. These are the words of Charles Best, the founder of Donors Choose, which allows teachers to take matters into their own hands and raise funds for what they see as their classroom's needs. From supplies to laptops. the site has seen over 2 million citizen donors step up to give more than $400 million to help 18 million public school students whose needs are often left unmet by under-resourced US public schools. It's one of the earliest and most successful crowdfunding platforms. Classes of kids will often send adorable thank you pictures and notes to their funders. One of many ways the platform has become so compelling. Yet not everyone is enthusiastic about Best's approach. In a profile of Donors Choose, Fast Company quotes Columbia University Professor of Political Science Jeffrey Hennig expressing an old power view of how education funding decisions should be made. "We have vested school boards, superintendents or mayor's offices with authority to make decisions about schooling because we understand they will be made out in the open, where questions of conflicting values are negotiated and compromises are made," he says. "It will be a collective process embedded with democratic procedures and discussion." Hennig is articulating the virtues of more centralized formal and representative governance over the vicissitudes of the crowd. He thinks education as a public good should be subject to resource allocation decisions that consider what's best and fairest for the system as a whole, rather than rewarding the most energetic or persuasive teacher. But Best is backing new power values, believing in the just-get-it-done devolutionary impulses of crowdfunding as a way to help kids now. It's Hennig who is defending formal governance processes and the idea of delegating authority to elected representatives, while Best champions the virtues of direct participation and individual agency. Notice that in crowdfunding models, more participation does not necessarily lead to more equal representation or inclusion. Sometimes new power can mean less of both. Those with a new power mindset have an aversion, which often comes with a dollop of disdain for the centralized bureaucratic machines that drove the old power world. They prefer more informal networked and opt-in means of getting things done. They despair of those who take their dusty places at the bi-weekly meeting of the Standing Deliberative Committee on Multi-Sector High-Level Decision-Making. More flash mob than United Nations, this philosophy stands in contrast to the 20th century belief in managerialism and institutionalism as the way to get things done. At the extreme, the belief in informal governance manifests in those Silicon Valley-led dreams of floating island paradises, an opt-in society outside the US run by technology. This is the kind of place, as one prominent Valley entrepreneur has advocated, where a Yelp for drugs replaces the US Food and Drug Administration, with doctor ratings and patient testimonials supplanting regulations and formal protections. Competition versus collaboration. New power models at their best reinforce the human instinct to cooperate rather than compete by rewarding those who share their own assets or ideas, spread those of others, or build on existing ideas to make them better. Many new power models, such as Airbnb, are driven by the accumulated verdict of the community. They rely on reputation systems that ensure that, say, rude or messy guests on the platform have trouble finding their next places to stay. A common-sense strategy to build followers on Twitter is to retweet and promote the thinking of others in the expectation that they will reciprocate. In a networked world, collaborating with your neighbor or someone on the other side of the world is both much easier and more frequently rewarded. The most successful open-source software engineers are the ones who collaborate best. They build on and improve the work of their peers, even when there's no obvious immediate benefit to them. Even big companies like GE are now talking up a radical shift in everyday working behavior toward collaboration. In contrast, those with old power values celebrate the virtues of being a great, and sometimes ruthless, competitor, defined by your victories. Dividing the world into winners and losers, this mindset considers success a zero-sum equation. It is the classic thinking behind much of corporate life and essential to the culture of sales teams in almost every industry. Donald Trump is steeped in these values, as is Uber, a especially under the leadership of its co-founder and former CEO, Travis Kalanick. Despite its new power model, Uber has a track record of sabotaging its competitors, intimidating journalists, and hoodwinking government regulators to come out on top. In a leaked document that detailed what it looked for in employees, Uber highlights fierceness and super pumpedness, all part of a hustle culture. It's worth noting that while norms around collaboration and sharing are now all the rage in our business and culture, that doesn't mean they always produce better outcomes. A recent study in applied psychology found that cooperative contexts proved socially disadvantageous for high performers who find themselves ostracized by the rest of the group. Confidentiality versus radical transparency. In the leaked transcripts of presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's paid speeches after leaving the State Department, she perfectly articulates old power norms about how information should flow. I mean, politics is like sausage being made. It is unsavory, and it always has been that way, but we usually end up where we need to be. But if everybody's watching, you know, all of the backroom discussions and the deals, you know, then people get a little nervous, to say the least. So you need both a public and a private position. To many young people, this pragmatic rationale for lack of transparency or straightforwardness just isn't acceptable anymore. In an era in which young people are sharing the most intimate details of their lives on social media, it shouldn't be surprising that in the workplace they are now demanding that their bosses share information previously considered strictly confidential, like company-wide salary information. The separation between public and private spheres, so prized in an old power world, is dissolving and is being replaced by an ethos of radical transparency. The great irony, of course, is that the more transparent people are in how they lead their lives, the easier it is for unseen forces to track their actions and shape their behaviours. The big clash here is between the need-to-know mindset, which instinctively keeps information away from the public for its own protection, and a rising right-to-know expectation where new power thinkers demand openness from institutions as a default. In the first case, experts and authority figures decide what filters information deserves. In the second, the filters don't exist. Across sectors, the old power world is absorbing a sustained attack on the hidden, with its dirty laundry increasingly exposed by WikiLeaks and in the Paradise Papers, for example, and its daily performance monitored. The once untouchable professor now must tolerate her teaching being rated online at any hour by neophyte students. In an age when it is ever harder to guard secrets and avoid scrutiny, some leaders and institutions are embracing radical transparency, if only as a preemptive strategy. To borrow a phrase from the world of protest, they are choosing to occupy themselves before they themselves are occupied. Our favourite example of this approach is that of 2018 Arizona gubernatorial candidate Noah Dyer, whose campaign website includes a section called Scandal and Controversy. In it, he declares the following. Noah has had both deep and casual sexual experiences with all kinds of women. He's had group sex and sex with married women. He has sent and received intimate texts and pictures and occasionally recorded video during sex. Noah has always been forthright with his partners. All of his relationships have been legal and consensual. Noah is unapologetic about his sexual choices and wishes others the same safety and confidence as they express themselves. We won't hold our breath for a similar declaration from Mitch McConnell. Experts versus makers. It really comes down to just being able to make something. Make something that's important. Always be creating. For me, it's that sweet, sweet, beautiful toasted bread. I'm Andy Corbett, and I make toast. That's a snippet from a 2016 ad that made light of maker culture, glorifying being a creator rather than just a passive consumer, and best of all, a hybrid, a coder, designer, engineer, doctor, musician, vet, is a big theme in new power culture. We can think of maker culture as the do-it-ourselves mindset, a phrase of Scott Heiferman, the CEO of Meetup, which reflects the idea that we should be makers, but in collaboration with others. We see this come alive in everything from amateur pornography to people printing shoes in their garages using online templates to gyne punks, groups of women taking care of their own reproductive health via homemade incubators and 3D printable speculums, to the surge in fan fiction communities like Wattpad. Makers are less dependent on institutions. They figure out how to avoid the intermediaries. This trend is allied with a shifting view of expertise. Restaurateurs, filmmakers, hoteliers, artists, and writers used to live in fear of the all-powerful critic whose expert opinion could tank or make their enterprise. Today, these elites still retain great influence, but increasingly, we look to one another for direction. Our world is a little more Yelp and a little less Fromers. In fact, over the last decade, the Edelman Trust Barometer has measured significantly increasing trust in people like me, which has reached higher levels than public trust in academic experts or doctors. This clash was dramatized by the run-up to the Brexit vote, when the "We Know What's Good For You In" campaign, seen as led by economic and cultural elites and technocratic experts, was swept away by the populist "Out" vote. Michael Gove, a senior government minister who favoured Brexit, exploited this sentiment, declaring during the campaign that people in this country have had enough of experts, pitting the economists who predicted Brexit would be bad for Britain against everyday people. This ploy enraged experts like the particle physicist Brian Cox, who said in response, "It's the road back to the cave. Being an expert does not mean that you are someone with a vested interest in something. It means you spend your life studying something. You're not necessarily right, but you're more likely to be right than someone who's not spent their life studying it." Long-term versus transient affiliation. Robert Putnam's now classic book, Bowling Alone, heralded declining civic health in the United States. To track this, he used a range of measures including attendance at a public meeting on town or school affairs, service on a committee for a local organization, and membership in a chapter-based organization. These standards speak to old power values around affiliation, which associate taking part with regular attendance and adherence to organizational charters and party platforms. But just as we cannot fairly measure the vitality of the media industry by the number of current cardholders at Blockbuster Video, we cannot fairly measure the health of civil society today by the number of members of clubs. Those with new power values are less committed, but more affiliative. And that's a paradox many old power institutions are now grappling with. Since the advent of the internet, we've seen a huge new wave of joining, affiliation, and participation, though not on the terms Putnam was seeking. New power loves to affiliate, but affiliation in this new mindset is much less enduring. People are less likely to be card-carrying members of organizations or to forge decades-long relationships with institutions, but they are more likely to float between meetup groups or use social media to very visibly affiliate with a range of causes, brands and organizations, and rally their friends to do the same. They tend to opt in at particular moments, and then opt out again. We shouldn't confuse this with a lack of engagement. Rather, it is a different way of taking part. This shift has big implications for organizations large and small. New power values in action. Welcome to the House for All Sinners and Saints. At the House for All Sinners and Saints in Denver, Colorado, we see many of these new power values in action. What makes Pastor Nadja Boltz-Weber different isn't the tattoos of religious stories all over her body, nor is it her media-friendly rags-to-dog-collar story. It's her congregation's simple philosophy. We're anti-excellence, pro-participation. Her church, the House for All Sinners and Saints, is booming, packed with millennials clearly speaking to a demographic that mainstream Christianity often struggles to reach. Much of that success comes from the way she has structured her church to accommodate and celebrate new power values. If you stop by one of its services, even as a first-time churchgoer, you might find yourself delivering the liturgy. Each service is performed by between 15 and 18 ordinary attendees who grab a part as they arrive and then collaborate to lead the congregation. And why is this so important? As Boltz-Weber explained to us, it sends a critical message. It's like telling people that we trust